Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Scary movie love for scary movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this Scary Movie Month episode of the podcast because I am joined to talk about Stir of Echoes by Mr. Rob DiCristino. Welcome back to the show, Rob.
Patrick, I believe that's Scary Rob DiCristino.
I'm very sorry. Scary Rob DiCristino. I forgot that you guys have been putting scary in front of your name. Rob, you were just on to talk about Creed recently. Are you excited to be back so soon?
I am more than excited to be back so soon because I have follow-up notes on movies that we'll talk about soon.
I cannot wait for this. All right, so we're going to be talking about Stir of Echoes from 1999 in just a little bit. We'll talk about what we have seen lately. We're going to read some of your seven-word reviews from the Scary Movie Challenge in just a second, but I want to remind everyone who's listening, every time you watch a scary movie in the month of October, go to fthismovie.com and click on the Scary Movie Challenge tab and enter a seven-word review for the movie that you watched. Our goal is to get as many of these seven-word reviews as we possibly can. Last year, we had, what, 3,100, roughly?
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, I know Miko has been keeping tabs on Twitter, which is super nice of him. Thank you. He's been like counting all the reviews and stuff. We're not on pace to beat last year's count right now, so my hope is that this is the fuel that gets everyone motivated to start putting their seven-word reviews.
I have to challenge you on that because okay. You always say that we start off strong, which
yes,
we did.
Yeah.
And then there's a sag in the middle where we're in the 80s, you know, somewhere in there, and then it really picks up in the last week. So if you do you add that variable in there when it comes to your consideration?
I have not. I have not. No, I did not.
Okay.
So because basically, I can't depend on a big push at the end, right? Like, I didn't go to Wisconsin and Michigan, you know, so I can't expect them to turn out at the very end the way I need them to. So
what we're trying to say, everyone, is pick it up.
Pick it up.
Look, Willow, what are you doing? You're not doing anything. You got time.
Yeah.
Look, there's four Wishmaster movies you could be watching.
I think I have some Wishmaster seven-word reviews. Actually, let's go ahead and read some of those right now. As is our way on the podcast during October, we always pick some of our favorite seven-word reviews. There's obviously way too many that I love to read them all, but let's read some of them. Rob, I will let you go first.
All right. TJ Mackey, 432 on Raw. A whole new meaning to finger foods.
Nice. I have this one from Jan Peters. Life Force, a favorite of mine. This was another case of functional nudity.
Dawn Hunt on Alien. Crew should have done more routine CAT scans.
That was a very funny one. Michael Shaw, Beyond the Gates. Beautiful Barbara bewitches boys into the beyond.
I had that one too. Damn it. All right. Ryan on Life Force again. Houston, we have a problem. What? Boobs.
I'm going to read one from Alejandra Gonzalez because last week I shamed her into writing some of them. I think she's only done like two or three. Step it up. Come on. But she wrote, Of the Fly, came for Goldblum, stayed for Gina Davis.
Nice one, Allie. All right, Adam Risky, our own Adam Risky on Scream. Skeeter boys always make things so complicated.
What a weird Avril Lavigne-specific review of Scream, but I appreciate it. Ryan S. of The Mist. I think I'll stick with Whole Foods.
Let's see. Rick on The Witch. I pray thee, don't trust the goat.
The Sonya Show, a.k.a. Sonya Mansfield, our friend, says of the Monster Squad, biggest monster of them all, Jason Hervey.
Daniel Downing on Wishmaster. I'd rather do dinner and a movie.
I definitely had that one. Michael Piccoli of The Thing, 1982. Perfect imitation of a seven-word review.
Let's see here. Miko Vinica, our friend Miko, on Morgan. From visionary director Rid Tone Luke Scott?
Ryan Byam of Tenement, a movie I've never seen. Chaco's use of third person troubled Ryan.
Cheery on Bad Moon. wolf and man make quite the pare.
we clearly are suckers for puns, because anytime there's a pun one, we gets read on the show. Andrew B. says of The Blob, this is one of the best ones of the month, The Blob 1988. Yes, and's his way to eye patch glasses. This is a very specific Del Close joke, everyone, so go ahead and Google Del Close.
Frank Levesque, sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong, Frank, on Pieces, finished way before the puzzle was done.
John Curvan of Torso, more cleavage than Andy Dufresne's rock collection.
Aaron Keith, oh, see, now I'm conscious of the puns. Hold on. Aaron Keith on Gerald's Game, ending exposition, handcuffs, and otherwise good movie.
Nice. Uncle Lou of Orphan from 2009. Adults grow so down... fucking... Adults. Let me try that again. Adults grow down so fast these days. It was a great 7-word review, Uncle Lou, and I blew it.
John Curvan on A Nightmare on Elm Street. Who left oatmeal on the staircase again?
I have one more from Brent Peterson, who had a bunch that I was having trouble choosing which one of Brent Peterson's I wanted to read, but I went with The Craft, Skeet, Brecken, Feruza, Nev. These aren't names.
I had that one too. All right. I've got a couple more. I'll read one more. And yeah, they're all puns. Damn it. Okay, hold on. All right. Cullen on Witchboard. Can't decide Ouija direction to go here.
Almost wrote that one and then resisted the pun, but it was a good one.
These have been great. These have been really good so far, everybody. Keep it up.
Is that your last one?
I have more I can do.
Yeah, keep going.
All right. Roger Cosino on Black Sunday. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Roger. Even with the mask, Barbara steals the movie.
Boom.
And then I'll end on our own JB on The Thing. Who goes there? Nobody, says The Thing.
Nice. Keep it up, everyone. These are really fun and really funny and really entertaining. And I am not good at this. So I am in awe of the skill that all of you possess to be really funny in just 7 words.
No, you are really good at this. And here's what I want to say about this year. And one of the reasons I think this is growing, even though maybe our numbers don't feel up to par yet. We're getting a lot more in these last few weeks than we have in previous years of actual reviews. Like, it seemed like for a while the tendency was for us all to kind of make the funniest joke possible.
Right.
But I feel like we're getting a lot of legitimate reviews of the movie this year. Did you get that sense?
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely stuff where I'll read a 7-word review and we'll file the title away as something I need to see.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's good. It's all good.
Especially Torso. When I read The Thing about cleavage, I was like, well, I need to see Torso. Just kidding. I've already seen Torso, everyone. Torso. That's the trailer. Right now, go on YouTube and look up the trailer for Torso. You will not be disappointed.
I'm going to do more than that because I subscribed to Shudder this year. For
oh, nice.
Movie month.
Yes.
And Torso went on my watch list right away.
I am very happy to hear that because it's a crazy movie, but a really cool movie.
Excellent.
Rob, have you seen anything scary lately?
I have. Speaking of Shudder, one of the very first things I think I watched on Shudder the other night was Inferno. Lucio Fulci, but
oh,
I mean
please.
Dario Argento.
Get it right, yeah.
I mean Dario Argento, of course, his film Inferno from 1980. It's not Suspiria, but there are some really, really weird and crazy moments in that movie. I really enjoyed it. The one note I have on it is I was really hoping after the first like 15, 20 minutes that it would keep moving from person to person and it would be this like horror version of Richard Linklater's movie Slacker. Like where we just go from person to person to person, but then it settles in on stupid Mark and his stupid mustache. But I really liked it. Where are you on Inferno?
I'm a big fan of Inferno. I like it quite a bit. I recognize that it's one of his least narratively satisfying movies. I know the narrative isn't necessarily the strongest part of Suspiria, but I find the narrative stronger even in Suspiria than in Inferno. But I find something very hypnotic about Inferno. I completely agree that the protagonist is kind of a tool and just not very compelling. But it's such a beautiful movie and there are amazing set pieces. And really, it's worth it just for that that gag near the end that I believe is credited to... Ah, shit. I would need to look this up. I feel like that's credited to Mario Bava, who I think helped out with some of the effects. Do you know the one I'm talking about? The skeleton in the mirror?
Yeah.
I mean, it's amazing.
It's pretty great.
I want to say Mario Bava helped out with that, but I could be misspeaking. But yeah, I'm a big Inferno fan.
It's great. And as you said, it's captivating and the cinematography. I mean, nobody lights a hallway like Dario Argento. And it's beautiful. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. Yeah. And I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
The other big one I watched was Society. I wrote about this the other day, so I won't mention it too much. Actually, I only just brought it up because I don't think I know your thoughts on that one.
I'm a Society fan. I don't disagree, based on what you said in your article, that like it has one metaphor that it really drives home. And yet, here we are in 2017, and think about how relevant that one metaphor continues to be. That was a movie that I actually saw a clip of. There were two films. I watched this documentary about horror films when I was in high school, and there were two clips that they showed of movies I'd never heard of. The first was a bullet going through a peephole, like a super close-up of a bullet going through a peephole and entering a woman's eye. And it was so cool that I was like, I need to track down that movie and see it. And that ended up being Dario Argento's Opera. The second was a human being turned inside out, essentially. And that was Brian Usna's Society. So I tracked that down and saw it as well. And it's a crazy movie, but I'm a huge fan of it. The last, 15 minutes are so bananas and like so repellent in terms of the level of squishy goo, which Brian Usna does very, very well. It's just such an amazing sequence that I think it's worth. I recognize that, the build up to that is kind of slow. I don't think Billy Warlock is the greatest screen presence to carry us through that story.
No.
But I think the payoff is so worth it. And I'm a fan of Brian Usna, who I should mention is producing Beyond the Gates too, and I could not be more excited about that. But yeah, I'm a big fan of Society.
Yeah, no, and I was writing that after, I think maybe a few minutes after I watched it, and I agree. I like the way, and one of the reasons why it gets away with that slow build is because the movie never goes into, like, it doesn't cut into like weird, like sleaze or like silly things that it doesn't need to get into. It kind of stays sort of straight and true, not narratively, in a way. And as you said, the characters are kind of wet blankets for a little while, but as it gradually builds, I love that shower moment.
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing.
For the obvious reasons, but
no, the movie maybe could have used two or three more of those because it's really like the shower gag. And then the one thing of like, Devin DeVasquez in the bed, right?
Right.
So I think, the shower is so good. If we won't spoil what it is if you haven't seen Society, but the shower gag is so good at kind of the what the fuckery. Like, what did I just see? What's going on? What does any of this mean? Where is this going? And so I wish the movie had a couple more of those moments. Although, to be fair, it's not like you could ever guess where it's going. Even with the obvious metaphor, like by the time you get to the sequence at the end, there's nobody who was like, well, I knew that this is where we were going to end up at the shunt.
Not at all. No. And again, those are minor nitpicks. And like, I really, really like the movie, and I really think it plays the goofiness, just the unabashed goofiness at the end is so great. And you really do see that it builds to that in an interesting way. And I think it's really fun. It's a really fun movie. I'm going to move quickly here. I watched Gerald's Game, as I know a lot of us did.
Yeah.
And I'm basically where you are. I thought it was really great, a really great handle on like the tone. And like, I really like the way that they played with the boundaries a little bit when she's in the room. And there's a really great kind of verisimilitude to the movie where it's like, you can tell that she's trying creative things in order to get out of her predicament. And I love bottle episodes. I've talked about this a little bit before. I love anything that takes place in a room. I love anything that takes place in one or two locations and is sort of about negotiating that location. And, but man, do I not like the end of that movie?
Yeah.
I really, because it's so like, I don't care about this Raymond person. I don't care about any of this. And you And he built the emotional catharsis of escaping the handcuffs. Like, everything builds, you know, and again, we won't spoil, but like, everything builds to that moment in both a narrative way, an emotional way, and in a, you know, a horror way, to that moment where it really sells why it's so important that she does it in that moment. And it's so cathartic, and it's so like, this is her overcoming all the things that she's gone through, you know, through the flashbacks and through the present moment. And it's, then it gets fleshed out and overexplained for 15 more minutes. And you're like, and I mean, the last shot is brilliant. I love the last shot, but you really did not need it. It's, and I haven't read the book. I think you mentioned in your review that that's the way the novel ends.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm with you in that we really should have lost that last 10 minutes or so. But that being said, it's still really brilliant. I really liked it a lot.
Yeah.
And Carl Gugino is great. And, you know, Bruce Greenwood, obviously. Yeah. Okay. I have one I'm saving. But the other one is William Friedkin's Sorcerer, which Horror Movie Police might grab me on this one. I don't know if it's technically a horror movie.
It's not a horror movie at all.
But it made me claustrophobic, anxious,
sure.
In desperate need of a shower. Yeah. Like it terrified me. So I'm counting it as horror. And I just really want to quickly note, because you know, you guys know Jaws is my favorite movie, and I have this really in-depth, deep connection with Roy Scheider, not only because Jaws is my favorite movie, but one of the reasons why Jaws is my favorite movie is because it reminds me and everyone in my family of my grandfather, who looked very much like Roy Scheider, and had similar character traits and whatnot. So I've always connected him through most of my life with the Chief Brody character. Like, I didn't even see the French Connection until a couple of years ago. And so Roy Scheider's overall body of work is still very foreign to me. And so adding Sorcerer to this, which he's great in, really made me want to kind of, I think I'm starting to like break loose of the Jaws connection, and I'm really starting to see him as more of an actor. Like, I still haven't seen all that jazz, you know, but like, I really want to now. So it did a couple things for me. It scared the crap out of me. And it also really made me really start to see Roy Scheider as more than just, you know, Chief Brody.
I had a weird relationship with Roy Scheider because, yeah, for years he was just like, oh, that dude from like Jaws and Blue Thunder, because for some reason that was the Roy Scheider connection in my head. And it wasn't until, I don't know, 5 years ago or so, where I realized that any time Roy Scheider showed up in a movie, the movie was pretty good, you know? Not to say that the movie is perfect, but like, if Roy Scheider's in it, I'm at least into it, because he's just one of those guys that is always awesome, and I'm always happy to see show up. I don't know if you've ever heard of it or seen it. There's a movie he made that Eric Red wrote and possibly directed in the late 80s, I want to say, called Cohen and Tate.
I have not.
Okay. It's a great, great Roy Scheider movie. You have to put up with Adam Baldwin, but, you know, yeah. Just don't follow him on Twitter and you should be fine. Because Roy Scheider just makes that movie worth seeing.
I am writing it down.
Cool.
I understand that Sorcerer is not technically a horror movie, but it scared me.
It's super intense.
Okay. All right. So a few weeks ago, you and I podcasted and we talked about a very special Halloween themed movie.
I know where this is going. I almost was going to text you and say, like, wait, I didn't hear the verdict. And then I realized, oh, he's saving it for the podcast. So I did,
of course,
not text.
Talking about the 2012 Nickelodeon original Fun Size, which Patrick so glowingly recommended a couple of weeks back, said it was like, you know, Keevan's like a masterpiece, and Chelsea Handler owns the show, and Victoria Justice is a person that exists. So you mentioned Adventures in Babysitting.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. It's this Adventures in Babysitting thing, but it has these things where it's trying to do super bad too.
Right. Like, yes.
It's really, I can't believe we mentioned this on the other show, but it was banned from Nickelodeon. It's the one of the first PG-13 Nickelodeon movies. And that's a shame, because the sex jokes are the worst ones in the movie.
Like, are we talking like the giant chicken that humps the car?
The giant chicken and like the boob thing with Jane Levy and like,
come on now.
I mean, okay, sure. But there are things in the movie that I like, but things in the movie that are just like you didn't need that. And so I felt a little bad, but you were totally right. Jane Levy is definitely the one who pops in that movie. I mean, she's clearly a star.
Yeah.
You know, Keevan, not so much. But
where is Keevan now, I guess, is the question.
Search for Kevin. Yeah, hashtag justice for Kevin.
Are you so excited that you own that movie now, though?
No, I rented it. I rented it on the Amazon. I'm sorry. No, I couldn't quite pull the trigger blindly. But, you know, it might become a Halloween favorite around here. I don't know. I'd watch it again.
See?
I think it's totally fine. It's a fun kids movie. You know, the Thomas Middleditch stuff is fine. Maybe a little less him, a little more.
Like he's the movie's McLovin.
Right, exactly. And you could tell that's sort of where they were going with it. And yeah, you know, maybe a little, say it this way, a little bit more Victoria Justice, a little bit more of the girls, maybe to even out those two things. Because I had a feeling that they probably just felt they could leave the camera on with Middleditch and just kind of let him go. And so they end up using a lot of that. But fun size is fun.
They should call it fine size. I've not gone back and rewatched it since our discussion because, I don't know, at some point maybe I will in October, but I feel like I'm cheating on actual horror movies if I watch that. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Sorry, no. I had a thing and then I didn't say it.
Anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay. I have a couple that I will talk about. I revisited sort of in preparation for this and sort of because I think it had just come up maybe on the most recent Shockwaves that Brennan Klein was on, when they were talking about Urban Legends Final Cut. Does that ring a bell? Okay, I don't know. I had not seen, because I think they were talking about Urban Legend, and then somebody said, I think the sequel is better. And I don't know. it's fine. You know, it's fine. Like, I'm not the world's biggest Urban Legend fan. I think Urban Legend's Final Cut is kind of a lateral move. It seems obvious, and I could be wrong about this, but it really seems to me that it was an existing script that then they decided to retrofit a little bit to make it an Urban Legend sequel, because it really has nothing to do with Urban Legends. It's all about like murders that take place at a film school. Jennifer Morrison is in it, and that was sort of the connection to Stir of Echoes that I was going to bring up. It's directed by John Ottman, who's a composer and an editor. So he kind of pulled triple duty on this, I think, which is fascinating. He wrote the music, he did the editing, and he directed the film. And he does a pretty good job directing it. I mean, he puts together some decent set pieces. I just find it hard to care about much of it. And it's so dumb about film so much of the time. Like, everyone's vying for the prestigious award that they give at their school, which is called the Hitchcock. And I was like, oh, because you knew, you know, audiences would know one director's name, and so they went with the Hitchcock.
It's like Picasso joke in Titanic,
right? It's just embarrassing.
Name an artist.
Exactly.
Name a director.
Right. And I just, if you're gonna make a movie about a film school, like, just act like you know some stuff. Joey Lawrence is in there for some reason, but he goes by Joseph Lawrence because I guess this is when he was being taken seriously as a director. I mean, the cast is fine. It's the whole thing's fine. Like, whatever. The only sequence that's worth mentioning, there's a thing in the middle where they go through. It's bananas because at a certain point you realize, oh, they're on the college's, you know, the college film school's massive sound stage, which has like is built to look like the old Universal lot from like the Wolfman and stuff. There's literally dry ice just hovering above the moors, you know, when no one is there filming. So this college has a pretty incredible film school, but there's a whole sequence in the middle that is really borrowed heavily / influenced by the Funhouse, which I think when I saw this movie opening weekend, I didn't put together. And now here it is, you know, 16 or 17 years later. And I'm like, oh yeah, that's totally the Funhouse. I can't really recommend it, but it's fine. Like of that, sort of slasher resurgence. There are worse movies. There are better movies. You know, I don't think a ton of great slashers came out of that sort of late 90s post Scream boom. And that includes most of the Scream sequels. I like Scream 2, and then everything else is kind of just, you know, variations of okay.
Have you seen Urban Legends Bloody Mary?
You know what? I have not. And there's not a ton that's compelling me to. I don't even know. This movie does a little post-credits thing that ties it into the first film, unnecessarily so, and I don't think that Bloody Mary pulls it all together. I don't think.
It has both Mara sisters in it.
Well, maybe I'll check it out. Listen, I'm not perfect.
Wait, I have to stop, Patrick.
Yeah,
no,
yeah,
because there's a tone permeating here.
Okay,
how are you rating your scary movie month so far? Where is it in the pantheon of scary movie months?
I don't know. It's okay. I've been watching a lot of new stuff, which the first few years of Scary Movie Month was kind of the death curse, because I would just like watch stuff on Netflix and I would just start to hate everything because most of it's bad. And so I've done a lot of that. You know, I've watched like just some brand new stuff on Shudder or Amazon Prime. I'm just like rolling the dice and watching stuff. I haven't seen a ton that I've outright been like, oh my God, that was awful. But I haven't seen a lot of new stuff that I've completely loved either. And I can't say that I've been rewatching a lot of favorites, because most of what I've rewatched has been stuff I haven't seen in a long time. You know, I'm not going to rewatch The Funhouse or Texas Chainsaw 2 or The Thing or anything like that during October, because I watch those all year. So there's certain movies like Urban Legends Final Cut where I'm like, oh, it's October. That's a good reason to revisit this thing that I probably wouldn't go back to in the middle of June or something. Sure. Who's to say? So it's going okay. How's yours?
It's good. It's very good. I didn't mention that I did the Halloweens
you did.
And the Nightmare on Elm Streets, because you could throw a rock and hit a podcast where they talk about all those, including a very good Corpse Club episode, this month, which everyone should check out. So I did a lot of homework in the first 2 weeks, and now I'm sort of moving into the more interesting stuff. So mine is good and getting better. I'm just checking in with you, buddy. That's all.
Sure. No, I appreciate it. Were there surprise standouts from any of those different franchises? It's hard to keep them straight.
New Nightmare is fun.
Okay.
I liked Halloween 6. I know.
Interesting.
It's
okay.
Bad. I know.
Which version did you watch?
I watched whichever one was on Amazon, I think.
Okay.
I don't know which one was which. I know it's a mess, but I was getting through those last couple in the Nightmare and the Halloween series, I just was giving points out for creativity.
Sure.
And just doing something different. And I think 6 is a mess, but it does kind of some different things stylistically and stuff. So it's a total mess. Other than that, you know, they're fine. They're fine. Dream Warriors is a fun movie.
All right. what else was I going to talk about? Yesterday for the first time ever, I have never seen an Amityville horror movie, period. I saw the remake with Ryan Reynolds a couple years ago, and that's only because I had a friend who worked on it. She was like a stand-in. And so opening night, we of course had to go see it, and I didn't love it. And then I forgot about it. I haven't seen it since. I've never seen any of the other Amityville films. And I've actually owned Scream Factory put out a box of the first three. And I've owned it for years and just still have never watched one of these Amityville films. It was sort of there with The Omen in terms of like these horror franchises that I just never really broke into. But because I was watching some stuff yesterday and it had just come up on that really, really terrific Pure Cinema podcast where they were doing horror triple features. And I think it was Jackson Stewart, previous podcast guest, who was talking about Amityville 2, The Possession, as being sort of the standout of that series, to which everybody else, I believe, agreed. You don't need to have seen any of the other Amityville films. There's a possessed house. Okay, got it. I knew that, so I understood where I was in the series. Your boy Burt Young is in there playing the biggest asshole father. I was fascinated by, like, how did Burt Young have a career? Which isn't to say that he's a bad actor or anything, but he's such a specific type. And when he's playing Uncle Paulie, you're like, yeah, is it? No. Cousin Paulie?
It's just Pauly.
Just Pauly. So I'm confusing it with Goodfellas. I'm confusing it with Goodfellas. Just Pauly. Yes. So when he's playing Pauly, you're like, yeah, of course. That's that guy, you know? But then when you put him in other movies, it's always like, huh, Burt Young? Okay. So he's just such a prick in this movie. Yeah, right? A very young Diane Franklin shows up in it. I don't know. It's a crazy movie to describe things that happen in it. Would sound weird. There's a large incest subplot that I just didn't see coming, but you so rarely do. And but I will say, like, I really dug it. You know, the third act kind of becomes The Exorcist, and I was less interested in that. I thought all the stuff in the house with the family was way more compelling. But I realized, aside from just the crazy stuff that I was enjoying because I like crazy stuff in movies, there's a sequence in the middle of the film that had me very tense and, you know, the closest thing to scared as I will usually feel in a horror film. I don't get scared that often, which, again, I say not to brag, just as a point to bring up, because that's not why I watch these movies. But I was watching it and I was nervous about what was going to happen. And I realized, like, yeah, that's basically being scared, right? Like, I'm uncertain and nervous about the thing that's coming. And so I realized, like, if this movie is having that effect on me, it's doing something right. And it gets written off as being crazy or being trash, and the franchise in general is sort of dismissed. But man, I thought it was really, really good. I'm way on board for Amityville 2.
It sounds excellent. And this is another point of full circle for us, because last year when we talked about The Silence of the Lambs, I brought up that I had finally watched the Amityville Horror, and I asked you if you had seen it yet, and you said no, and we had a discussion about the sequels, and you said, oh, you know, I always heard that the second one is great.
Yeah.
And you'd mentioned that you were going to try to see it, so it's nice to see that
come full circle. It only took me a year.
And I'm glad.
You know what this means? There's hope yet for Mirrors. I might see Mirrors. The last movie I'll talk about is a movie that I know a lot of people have watched this past weekend because I've seen a lot of 7-word reviews for it, and that is The Babysitter, the new Netflix original that dropped on Friday, directed by Mick G. Yeah, and starring Samara Weaving, which some of you may know from season 1 of Ash vs. Evil Dead. Once Joe Lynch's next film, Mayhem, comes out, I'm hoping many more people will know Samara Weaving because she's terrific in it. And she is the best part about The Babysitter. Did you ever see Detention, the Joseph Kahn movie?
I don't think so.
Okay. That's kind of a love it or hate it movie. And there are a lot of people who really, really love it. I am maybe not in that camp. I might plant my flag maybe in the other camp. I find it just obnoxious in how aggressively energetic and would be hip and cool it is. And this to me feels like McGee trying to do Joseph Kahn. So there's like just ridiculous camera work and text that shows up on the screen. Like, really, we're still doing this? It's 2017. We really still need to put text on the screen to say who characters are. Samara Weaving is great. Again, she's not in the movie enough. It goes to some unexpected places. I give it credit for being watchable. I give it credit for having a lot of practical gore effects and really going over the top with some of the gore in a way that's pretty fun. But then there's just so many things that rub me the wrong way, including, and maybe I'm just overly sensitive to some of this stuff now based on what's been going on in Hollywood and on social media and, you know, all of these revelations about just how gross and awful Hollywood is and how actresses are treated. And so there's just scenes where, like, she goes swimming and the camera just lingers on her body in this way. Or there's another scene where she makes out with another actress who's somebody famous. I can't remember her name. She's a redhead. It doesn't matter. But where, you know, she's dressed in like a provocative little cheerleader outfit and they make out and it's in super slow motion and the camera's up there like with their tongues touching. And I'm sure McGee would be saying like, well, no, I'm parodying that moment, or I'm showing the movie like how a 14 or 12 year old boy would be seeing it. Like, okay, these are all fine arguments for your artistic justification for this bullshit. But like at the end of the day, all you're doing is just lingering on this to give, you know, men something to jerk off to. And I don't know, just the moments like that left kind of a bad taste in my mouth. That's not even my biggest objection with the movie. It just was more evidence that I think McGee is kind of a hack, you know, and I say this as somebody who really enjoys the first Charlie's Angels film. So it's not that he's never made a movie that I like, and I don't think he's without talent. I just think he is of questionable taste and makes a lot of garbage choices and often seems to be chasing what someone else is doing instead of trying to do his own thing. And Charlie's Angels was the closest I think he ever came to like, hey, here's who I am. Here's my style. I'm going to make my kind of a movie. And then every other movie he's made has been sort of imitation of something else, including the Charlie's Angels sequel, which was like him imitating himself. Anyway, The Babysitter, watch it. It's fine. Like, it's 90 minutes. It's on Netflix, so it's real easy to access. And there's some decent stuff in it, but overall, I was not a fan.
Better or worse than 3 Days to Kill?
God, that was McGee too, wasn't it? I feel like that movie kind of bored me, so I would say better, even though I didn't really like The Babysitter.
I'm looking at McGee right now. Charlie's Angels was his first feature.
Yes.
And which it says a lot. And then, yeah, it's We Are Marshall, Terminator Salvation, This Means War. Yeah, that's yeah, I don't know. I don't have an opinion on McGee, but douche chill.
Yeah, exactly. And this feels kind of like a douchey movie, you know, and whatever. Bella Thorne, by the way, is that actress's name. Bella Thorne, which how could I not remember Bella Thorne, right? She was named at the same school as Victoria Justice. But again, Samara Weaving is great. And if you're only going to see one Samara Weaving movie this year, just wait a few more weeks and see Mayhem instead.
Samara Weaving, the niece of Hugo Weaving, not daughter.
I did not know that.
Yep. Had to know.
Anyway, so that's what I've seen. Let's talk Stir of Echoes. That's what everyone is tuning in for. This
Stir of Echoes podcast.
Finally, they're going to tackle Stir of Echoes.
The best one since Cool World.
This was your pick, so I'm going to let you take the lead in terms of what was it that made you want to maybe revisit Stir of Echoes after all these years.
Hold on, it was kind of my pick.
Well, okay.
No, it was. No, I get it. No, yeah, I was looking at, we were talking about what to do for Scary Movie.
Yeah, yeah,
I'd
it wasn't like, I was, of all movies, I want to do Stir of Echoes.
I was looking at late 90s horror, which apparently Adam Riske has been too. And I was looking at movies like this, like Stir of Echoes or like The Faculty or something, you know, something like that. And I threw out a couple titles over text to you and you threw back Stir of Echoes. You said, let's do Stir of Echoes. You know, it's probably a good show in that. So, I this one is one I have not seen since the theaters. I remember seeing this in the theater with my friends at the McDay Mall Theater in 1999, back when we saw everything. I don't remember anything about it. I didn't remember really anything at all about it, except obviously Kevin Bacon and A Stirring of Echoes. I remember that it was, I remember thinking, because maybe we'll talk about this, that it felt very much like it got swallowed up by The Sixth Sense.
Yeah.
Because this year was Blair Witch, The Sixth Sense, and The Mummy, just in terms of sort of top box office horror.
And the remake of The Haunting. Let us never forget of The Haunting.
But this one, revisiting it, it's fine. It's good. It's good. I think. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's a strong movie. I remember really being a fan of it in 99 when I saw it and wishing that it wasn't being overshadowed by Sixth Sense. And I think at the time, and maybe this was just me being like, trying to, you know, I like the Monkees, not the Beatles. I think I was like, Stir of Echoes is the better movie. And revisiting it, I'm not sure that it is.
I think it's closer than a lot of people would admit, though.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And there's, it's just, their concerns are so different. And, you know, as I was initially watching it, I was like, well, this is a much warmer movie than Sixth Sense, because Sixth Sense does have kind of a chilly vibe to it by design. And I don't feel like that's giving credit to some of the things that Sixth Sense does well in terms of some of its humanity, whether it's the relationship between Bruce Willis and Haley Joel Osment, or more specifically, the relationship between Haley Joel Osment and Toni Collette. I don't always think of those things when I think of The Sixth Sense, which isn't fair, because I think that stuff is really strong in that movie. But otherwise, I do think it's a slightly colder movie than Stir of Echoes, which I don't think, oddly enough, works nearly as well as a ghost story or even as sort of a supernatural thriller as I do, as it works as like kind of a domestic drama. And this is not me playing that whole, like, it's a social thriller. Because I recognize that A Stir of Echoes, or just Stir of Echoes, is still a horror movie. It's a ghost story. There's stuff in it that is horrifying. Fingernails. And that's hard to watch. Yeah, that the fingernail stuff is... Oof. Anyway. So... But I find myself caring way more about the marriage between Kevin Bacon and Catherine Irby, and the way that the movie is so much about community, which I don't think a lot of movies are. And I thought it was so interesting revisiting it this time, how important sort of the town is in that movie. Just everyone going out together and hanging out together, and your neighbors are a big part of your life. And it's not a movie that gets talked about ever when people talk about their favorite Chicago movies. But as I was watching it, I was like, I don't know why that is, because it shows such a different side to Chicago. I think usually when people think about Chicago movies, they're like, well, you know, Untouchables and Ferris Bueller, they have all the big landmarks and all the big set pieces. And Stir of Echoes is very much about regular streets and is much more of like a blue collar horror film than something like The Sixth Sense. But those are the things about it that I really like.
I agree. I think it works way better in the terms you're saying. Although I do admit, or I will kind of admit that I feel like a lot of the relationship stuff doesn't work as well as maybe I would want it to. And I think a lot of the community stuff gets a little bit lost, so that when it comes up and becomes important, it kind of feels a little bit out of nowhere. But I think that's because the movie kind of gets distracted with the ghost stuff, which doesn't really, I don't know. There's like three quarters of a really solid movie here. There's really interesting. I don't know. I have so many things to say about this movie. Okay. First of all, it's written and directed by David Koepp, who like is solid, right?
Yeah.
Like we would admit, I looked him up. He's the sixth most successful screenwriter in terms of box office. He's written some great movies. He's written Jurassic Park. He wrote Snake Eyes, which is a De Palma movie I really like. He wrote the first Spider-Man. He also wrote Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, and he wrote The Mummy of 2017, Dearly Departed, The Mummy of 2017, which is a big pile of garbage. Sorry, Heather. He wrote Carlito's Way. He wrote Mission Impossible. You know, he's like a solid studio screenwriter. Like, he gets the job done. He's the Ron Howard of, you know, whatever, studio screenwriting. And it's based on the novel by Richard Matheson, who wrote the original I Am Legend novel. And he was apparently a big writer on the Twilight Zone original series. And that's what I was picking up on in the first 10, 15 minutes. It felt very much like at first I said Stephen King, and then I was thinking, like, this is very much a Twilight Zone episode. It feels a lot like that. But I have a couple questions to start. First of all, you mentioned community. You mentioned this idea that the people are always, why are these parents constantly going out to keggers? Like, are they going to interact with their son at any point in the movie? Is there going to be any sort of parental, you know, I'm joking, obviously, but I definitely got that sense of like strangeness in the relationship from the beginning. Like, the first thing he says to his wife when he finds out she's pregnant is a bummer. And I know there's an intent to that. Like, I guess the performances are like pitched with this like weird urgency or intensity that like is unsettling. I don't know. I think that just the way that the characters are meant to come together, like you mentioned the movie being warm. I don't know that I necessarily find all the inroads for their connectivity in a way that feels meaningful. And I think a lot of it is because, and I'm bouncing around a little bit here, but I think this movie needs a first act. I don't think this movie really has a first act. And I'm a story wonk. Like I love, you know, my Joseph Campbell. I love things to go the way I want them to. And I really want to see like the normal world. And we get like 2 minutes of a normal world before things start to go wrong. And I really feel like I would have gotten a lot more out of the husband and wife thing. And it wouldn't have felt so strange from the beginning if we had gotten a little bit more of that. Am I just like misreading? Because I feel like no normal world means that there's no real like character traits or skills to help him in the end. I mean, we could talk about the ending, you know, in a bit and how he's sort of, you know, saved in a to me a little bit of an unsatisfying way. I would like to have seen more character development and get more of like a weird like Stepford vibe from this than have it spend so much time with the ghost story. I don't know. Am I off base here?
I don't think you're off base. I think, you know, I think maybe we just start coming at it from two different places, because I agree with what you're saying in terms of it essentially introduces them. We find out she's pregnant, which is a thread that is then forgotten for the rest of the film. I literally don't think it comes up again.
It does not.
Which is kind of strange. And then they go out to this party, and Ileana Douglas, who is a lot of fun in the movie, does her little hypnotism trick, and we're off and running. You know, the door has been open, and now he's starting to be visited by ghosts. So I get what you're saying. At the same time, I do think that the film does a fine enough job filling in who these people are and what their lives are before it gets all consumed with the ghost story stuff, that I don't ever feel like I don't get the relationship. I don't get who they are. And
yeah,
that's one of the, again, one of the strengths for me is that it shows me a couple and a group of adult friends. And I don't have adult friends who I'm constantly going out drinking with or going to the college football game with or whatever, but I know these people and I know that they exist, and they don't often exist in movies. And I hate to keep using the words blue collar, but there's something that's very sort of not even, I would almost say lower middle class, just because again, the movie makes a point of saying that they're renting this house and, that money is a concern, right? When Catherine Irby talks about he's going to run out of his sick days and then what are we going to do? You know, I think that the movie gives these people a life that they are, it drops us into the middle of a life that is very much lived in. They have concerns that aren't just about like, hey, Kevin Bacon, you're sure acting weird or whatever. Like, I buy all of the stuff. I buy their marriage. I buy them as parents. I buy the friend group. Now, I will agree with you, and I guess, you know, spoilers for A Stir of Echoes. Like almost every ghost story, the ending is unsatisfying. And there's a very specific movie that I can point to, and I don't want to because I don't want to spoil the end of another ghost story that I really like that came out in like 1987, 88. You could probably figure it out. It kind of came out on Scream Factory, and there's a podcast on it. But it's a good movie, but it does the same thing. I don't like that the mystery, and again, I can't put myself back in my own shoes in 1999 when I was seeing this movie, but I do feel like seeing the movie the first time when I didn't know what he was looking for when he starts digging, and I don't know what he's going to find, and I don't know who this ghost is or what she wants. I think that mystery was probably a lot more compelling than it was when I was watching it this time, which is much more of like, now I have to wait around till they figure out what I already know. And there's an impatience that I have as a viewer. And so maybe that's why I was picking up more on just the regular day-to-day relationship stuff, which we can talk about more in a little bit. But, you know, the resolution of the mystery is what it is. The problem with almost every sort of supernatural film or ghost story is they have to ground it in some sort of real-world explanation. And what Stir of Echoes does, unfortunately, is grounds it in an answer that isn't particularly compelling, right? Oh, she was accidentally murdered, and dumps all this exposition into Kevin Bacon's brain in one scene. But not only that, she was accidentally murdered by like the four people that he knows and is closest to, and they covered it up. And there's this way of making the world so small that will always disappoint me in these kinds of movies where it, you know, it suggests the possibility of life after death and that there are spirits out there who have unfinished business and they're trying to send us messages, but like, it only goes as far as next door, basically. And it's like, wow, the universe is so tiny for having ghosts in it. And so I agree that the resolution isn't particularly satisfying. But I like everything up to that enough that I can overlook it.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think we're closer than maybe I originally thought we were. Because I think my frustration is I'm looking at the Kevin Bacon character and I'm trying to understand why he's invested in this particular story. And I think one of the reasons why the climax and the resolution feels so unsatisfying is because, like, again, these are people that we, you know, we met and we get this sense of community. But like, you know, he doesn't have a relationship with these kids. He doesn't have a particular investment aside from living in the same house as the girl. I didn't get as much of his connection, and I didn't get as much of his, like, if I had a little bit more time, and again, you know, this might just be me, you know, needing a little bit more setup and stuff. And maybe they wisely thought that let's jump to the exciting part. I would have liked to have seen a little bit more of his concern, a little bit more of his, I'll put it this way, aside from just like wanting to be Joe regular guy, a reason why he wants to be in this, you know, you got Kevin Dunn, good old Kevin Dunn, talking about like all the girls his son is banging, like, and like, you know, the wives are always talking about boners and all that. Like it's a interesting community of people, like you mentioned. And I want that like motivation. I want his, like, I want to understand why Kevin Bacon wants to be normal. And you mentioned a lot of things that are perfectly fine, like blue collar, low, you know, lower middle class, just trying to get by and all that, and connectivity with your neighbors. But like, it really does feel not only, like you said, that the resolution makes the world, or the answer to the mystery makes the world smaller, but that it literally could have been anything. Like, it could have been anything. And that's one of the things I wrote down, which was like, I would like to read the book, first of all. And I also think that this would be like a cool conceit to explore in like a 10 episode prestige TV series. Like the whole, like, 6 months ago, this happened and you just happened to be in the house it happened in thing is like really convenient, like you said, and it's not that exciting. Bacon doesn't really have a strong connection to anything in that particular story. And it feels like it could have been replaced with literally anything. And I think that's why the lack of setup in the world, just again, because for me, and I'm discovering this about myself the more I watch movies, I'm a story guy. I will watch a movie of any genre as long as it has a good story. And I think that I was missing some of the things that I really wanted in the setup of Kevin Bacon's character, and his relationship with his wife. I thought that there was some stuff with the wife. I feel like she's a little underwritten and a little bit rushed. I actually thought there was like a Sixth Sense thing going on for a while because she was being ignored, which I understand is, you know, part of what the movie is getting at. But I guess I just would have liked a little bit more of that in order to help the payoff feel a little bit more earned. So it's I don't know. I'm with you. It's just I found that particular part to be a little bit just underwhelming.
I think the payoff, as it's written, is unfortunately going to be underwhelming no matter how they build up to it, because, you know, Kevin Bacon's role in this, I mean, the whole point of it being him is that he's not involved, is that he doesn't necessarily have a personal connection, and that's what, to me, makes it interesting. And you know, there's two scenes that essentially set this up and pay it off, and I would argue somewhat heavy-handedly, but okay. I think it's just good enough between the performances and the writing to kind of skate by. But we have a scene very early on, after Kevin Bacon kind of says bummer about the pregnancy, he explains, you know, I'm not always going to be a lineman. I had told you early on, you know, that I was going to be something more, and I promised you some things, and I don't want you to feel like that was all talk. And so we get a sense of who they were when they got married and kind of how things have shaken out. Catherine Irby has that great scene later in the movie when she says, you know, you say all this stuff is stupid, but then you're saying that our life is stupid and I'm stupid and I don't feel that way.
I like that scene. It's a good scene.
I can't say enough good things about Catherine Irby in this movie. But so then, and I believe that that comes right after the other scene that I'm talking about, where he kind of freaks out at her in the backyard and says, this is the most important thing I've ever done. And, you know, this is the biggest thing I've ever done in my stupid life. And so I think that's really what's driving him, is this feeling that he has been chosen for something bigger, that he's a nobody. And yet all of a sudden he's been given this power and seeing something that other people aren't seeing, and has an opportunity to figure something out and, you know, essentially solve a mystery. He doesn't know why. He doesn't know how it's happening, but he feels like, if I do this, it will matter and I will matter. And to me, that's the thing that drives him the whole movie. So actually his disconnect from it makes that arc work better for me, because if it was like, I got to find out what happened to my niece, then that becomes the driving force behind all of it. But instead, it's his own need to feel like he's doing something that will matter, because he's obviously not feeling that. And again, that scene where he kind of freaks out to Catherine Irby, it's like a little bit on the nose, because he basically speaks the subtext. But then at the same time, you know, I have to cut the movie a little bit of slack, because it's also making a point of saying that he's going a little bit crazy through all of this. You know, he's becoming obsessive and a little bit unhinged, and he's drinking all this orange juice, and he's got, oh my God, maybe my favorite line in the movie is when he's digging, when she first sees him in that same scene, and the sun is digging also a little bit further away, and he goes like, don't worry, it's not over there. Like, he's assuring her that the kid's not going to find anything because it's not over there. And I just, his confidence, the way he says it, I just love so much. It's like a moment of levity that isn't just an obvious joke line, you know? Yeah. So that kind of arc works for me. Again, it's like 80% of the way there. You know, I don't think it works totally. And as you said, no matter what, none of that really factors into the actual resolution, right? I mean, none of that actually plays a part in, oh yeah, it was these people who did it. It happens to be your neighbors and your friends, and a bunch of people get shot. Like, all that shit is so uninteresting, you know? And to give the Sixth Sense credit, it pretty much avoids all of that stuff, which I admire, you know, that it doesn't just become people fighting and regular humans killing other humans, like the end of Ghost or this other movie that I was referencing earlier. None of that stuff is very interesting. But in terms of, and Kevin Bacon, you know, I think is such a great actor who isn't always acknowledged as being a great actor. And he, like Roy Scheider, makes everything he's in better. And I think he's only gotten more interesting in the last, you know, 20 years with some of the stuff he's doing. Having said that, in 99, I don't think I noticed, but I definitely noticed when I was watching the movie today, like, he's back a little on the Chicago Kevin Bacon. Like, he's pushing the Chicago thing a little bit hard when nobody else in the movie is. And I'm like, all right, we get it. You're in Chicago, but like, relax a little bit with that nonsense. I still think he's great in the movie.
Yeah, no, he's great. The performances in this movie are really good. Again, I like this movie. Like, I'm not. I'm very much, you know, like I said, I think it's one of that issue where we like something so much, we wish it was just that little bit better.
For me,
and while your explanation and your sort of connectivity with the everyman plot there, it makes sense to me definitely when you explain it. For me, whatever buttons weren't being pressed for me when I was watching the movie. That being said, the other thing that I really need to bitch and moan about here is the sun. The movie goes out of its way. In fact, I believe begins with the child, talking to someone who's, you know, unseen. We later find out who that is. There's a part where the mom, Catherine Irby goes to talk to a guy about how her son has, you know, the shine on him, and and then it disappears from the movie until the last shot, which is basically like a sequel hook. Like, that's, that to me is, that's, there's so much there. Not that I need to see that particular story, because, you know, Sixth Sense and The Shining, as I mentioned, like, there's lots of movies like that. But, like, in this particular story, I feel like there's a way, you know, even though, as, like you mentioned, the two of them are digging, and the son, there's that great moment where he's trying to figure out the chords on the guitar, and the son comes over and shows him how to do it. Like, it's understated, and I can appreciate that understatement. Just from a filmmaking perspective, and I understand that, but I would have loved to have seen just a little bit more. Like, I would like the son to have had an arc. Like, I think that would have been really interesting.
Yeah, I don't disagree. And I think the movie is messy in ways that I didn't register the first time I saw it. And I don't totally mind, as you know, I'm somebody who kind of enjoys the mess, especially when the mess is doing interesting things. And even if it doesn't all connect cleanly, I'm okay with that, especially in a movie like this, where I think the messiness, and I don't mean the messiness of the construction, so this isn't me excusing your point about the sun, which is well taken. Some of the mess in terms of the movie, I think helps lends itself to that sort of lived in feeling that their life is a little bit chaotic, and that's okay, you know, and that's why it feels authentic to me. But, you know, messy film construction and messy life are two kind of separate issues. The reason I bring that up is because David Koepp does a really interesting thing in terms of the son talking to the ghost. I agree with you that it, you know, he can talk to ghosts. It doesn't really go anywhere. I guess the implication is, you know, because Kevin Bacon is able to talk to ghosts, that the son, you know, was kind of born with this doorway open. And is that something that all children are born with, and then it closes off as we get older and, you know, our minds get filled with other concerns? Or is this kid super special? I like all of his scenes. I like the way that he talks to, you know, the ghost off camera and fills in certain stuff. And when he tells Catherine Irby to call the babysitter, like, I like all that. Paris from Gilmore Girls. But what David Koepp does that I think is really interesting is every time he talks to the Jennifer Morrison ghost, he's looking directly into camera. That's how the movie opens. And then every time he talks to her again, he's looking directly into camera. And I can think of a bunch of other movies. Poltergeist is, you know, the first one that jumps to mind, where it's shot from the parent's perspective and we are looking down at the kid talking to somebody that we can't see.
Yes.
And so I think it's very interesting that David Koepp puts us in the sort of ghost seat, which was the original title for this movie, ghost seat, and looking into, you know, looking directly face to face.
Sits on the ghost tree. On the ghost ship.
Sitting, looking face to face with the kid. And I think that's really interesting because I think, you know, one of the things that I like about the movie, but that also makes it sort of sloppily constructed, which is maybe what you're getting at, is that it's a movie that is almost told from three different perspectives, and it doesn't always seem deliberate in how it switches those perspectives. So it doesn't feel like a movie that comes out saying, like, okay, we're telling this story from three different positions, the kids, the moms, and the husbands. Because you just sort of assume that it's Kevin Bacon's story, and yet why are we opening talking to the kid, right? And why are we ending talking to the kid? And so his perspective obviously matters a great deal, but the movie doesn't totally make that clear. And Kevin Bacon kind of takes a back seat for much of the middle of the movie, and it becomes Catherine Irby's movie, which I'm all on board for. And that's one of the things I like about the movie. I will say that, like, I like the kid being able to talk to ghosts, and I like Kevin Bacon being able to talk to ghosts, and I like that Catherine Irby is feeling left out, because I, again, as you said, I think the movie is trying to say something about what it means to be a parent and what it can sometimes feel like to be a parent and different things that we are scared about as parents, which you and I can both relate to. And I like that we don't see the scenes where they whisper to each other and leave her out of it. She's just describing it to her friend as a frustration. She doesn't know what's going on. She feels like she's becoming alienated from her own family. Like, all that stuff lands for me, even if we don't see it. I've gotten so far from where I started, which I think was talking about the kid. But yeah, I think one of the things is it keeps switching perspectives without feeling like there's a clear plan in place to do so.
Yes. And I think you hit really the nail on the head with that. And I wrote down when I was taking notes while I was watching it, I said, you know, the point of view is tight and tense. It gets right into, you know, Kevin Bacon's isolation. You're not sure where it's going to go. Because I love the moments where once he starts to realize what's going on, there'll just be these little camera moves or these little sound cues where, you know, he'll see something and then he'll move and then it'll stop and then he'll turn around and something's there and then it isn't. And, you know, I would have liked to have, you know, maintained that sense of paranoia. Or at the very least, like you said, maybe a little bit more artfulness in terms of knowing when each perspective changes, knowing when we're going from his perspective, Catherine Irby's perspective, to the kids. And it might just be, you know, I'm just a dummy who needs the movie explained to me a little bit more, or I'm not reading as much of the subtlety. But I really, you know, thinking about it through that lens, like you just mentioned, you know, I really do agree. And I think I think that the son character does have a lot of interesting moments. And I think that, as you said, Catherine Irby's sort of isolation is another really, really interesting part of the movie. And I think really what I'm getting at is that I wanted all these things and I wanted more of them, I think, is what my complaint basically comes down to with this movie, which is why I kind of, again, I know this is sort of sacrilege, but I would have liked to have seen this maybe as a 8-episode Netflix series, maybe. Yeah.
I almost feel like, would this be a better movie if he didn't solve a murder? That he found the body, and then that was kind of it? That, like, right, the family was given closure, and the spirit was given closure, because, like, hey, I died in this house. And I understand that every audience would be like, well, what? How did she die? Why is she there? Why is she buried? Like, you know. It has to then, unfortunately, become a standard murder mystery plot. But, like, that shit is just the least interesting stuff in the movie. And, again, the build-up to all of that is so cool. I also think that that's where David Koepp is at his weakest as a director. I think the more kind of horror/supernatural elements of the film don't quite work. I like some of the flashing imagery, the tooth and the fingernail, like I said.
The tooth is great.
But, like, the jerky walking and the kind of rapid fire editing as we get later into the film when, you know, more stuff is being explained, I don't think that stuff works as well. I do like the single shot after she is essentially, her soul is kind of freed, where we see her in the three different places, up in the window and then down and then on the sidewalk putting her glasses on. I thought that was a neat way to visualize that. And his most sort of stylistically bold thing that he does that I really, really love and have thought about a lot since I saw this movie almost 20 years ago is the movie theater stuff with the hypnotism.
Yes.
With the big screen and the word on the big screen and the floating chair. It's so great.
Great. It's really great. Yeah. And it's right away too, which really, like, I was sunk into my seat for the movie because I was like, oh man, that is awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to mention real quick, the tooth thing looked really good. Just from an effect perspective. And I don't know, are you a person that has the tooth dreams? Are you a person that has your teeth are falling out dreams?
No, but I think Erica does.
Okay. Okay. They say that's vanity. I don't think
Erica does. She has a thing where, like, she can't find her shoes. I don't know what that is.
Oh, okay.
But maybe, right. Maybe she doesn't have the tooth. I don't think I've ever had the tooth thing.
I never have the running or the falling dreams. I have dreams where my teeth are falling out. So I definitely was with him on that one.
You vain son of a bitch. Here's a weird dream that I have. It's not running or falling. It's floating. Where, like, I'm floating off the ground and I keep going higher and higher and all I want to do is come down and I can't. Because Erica's always like, we should try parasailing. And I was like, that's literally a nightmare that I have on a regular basis where I'm just like hovering above the ground and I can't come down. That's a horrible feeling that I never want to experience.
Do you have a heights thing?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah. Yeah. No. I think it's a control. I don't know. Yeah. So anyway, I'm vain and you have a floating.
And I'm controlling. Thing. Yeah. Yeah.
And you're controlling. Yeah. So, okay. Where was I going to say? I don't know where we're at here. Let's see. Okay. Tooth effects, we said. Roger Ebert pointed out in his review that the digging thing kind of echoes Close Encounters, which I thought was kind
of... Yeah, I mean, his whole arc kind of does.
To an extent, yeah. Which I thought was kind of cute. Yeah. Okay. So what you were saying about the murder mystery thing, and again, this is me back on my bullshit with story arcs. He doesn't actually do anything. I mean, he uncovers it and he survives the encounter with the dad and the son, but like he doesn't master anything. He doesn't, I mean, unless I really miss something in terms of using that connection with the other side in order to do. So he doesn't feel like an active protagonist at the end of the movie. Again, not that you always have to be, I'm not, you know, being that way about it, but I would have liked to have that build up. I think we keep saying that build up is really great and then the payoff is not so great, and that the payoff is not going to be really great no matter what you do. I think there are ways to have you could have made it a little bit better. And all it really would have taken was like maybe him not getting knocked to the ground and waiting for his wife to save him. Not that Catherine Irby isn't capable and wonderful and doesn't have her own great arc in the movie, but like I would just really would have liked to have seen a little bit more of that toward the end. Those would have been my notes in the script that the director would have wisely ignored.
Again, I don't disagree with how you're feeling, but at the, you know, because how can I? But at the same time,
I just don't care. That's all.
I don't agree with your emotions. But at the same time, I don't mind that. And again, I don't think the movie does a great job of actually articulating a lot of these things that I'm sort of giving it credit for doing. So I recognize that I'm probably reaching or reading too much in, but I don't mind the sort of reveal, if you will, and it's never an official reveal, that he's not really an active participant, or that he doesn't necessarily do all this stuff save for find the skeleton, which even that sort of just happens because he has a dream that says dig again, because, you know, this spirit world is communicating with him. But I kind of like the realization at the end of the film that he's really just a vessel, that he hasn't necessarily been granted superpowers, that he's not there to like solve a murder so much as like bear witness as it plays itself out. And I do like, you know, that his first thing is like, we got to call the cops. I don't mind the fact that he turns out to just be a vessel. Because again, it does fly in the face a little bit of this idea that he wants to be special, that he wants to be more than, and he has completed that function. But at the same time, it's not him becoming Neo at the end of the movie. You know,
right.
He's more just like this vessel through which, and the one who's actually special, the one who's truly gifted, is his son, and that's what that last moment tells us. And you know, of course, it's also a curse, as we can tell by reading the son's facial expression. But perhaps giving birth to this son who has this special gift is Kevin Bacon's function. Maybe that's his higher purpose, you know? So I don't know. I don't mind, again, the realization that he's still more or less an ordinary guy who lived through something extraordinary, but who wasn't made a superhero because of it. And I know you're not arguing for him to become a superhero. I know exactly what you're saying. I can just picture a worse version of this movie that does some of what you're talking about, but goes in the wrong direction, where you're like, ooh, I thought I wanted that, but it turns out I don't want this version of it.
And does just as little to earn it as this movie does in the other direction.
Exactly,
yeah. No, I totally agree. Yeah. And I think what I might be doing, which is something we do often, is I'm looking at the movie for what I expect of it rather than what it is. I need to maybe rewatch this movie on its own terms.
Yeah.
And in that case, maybe I'll find more. But again, I still really like this movie. So.
Yeah, it's weird because, again, we've had this really interesting conversation about it. And I won't say, though, I love Stir of Echoes. I think it's really solid. I think it's, you know, I would probably call it underrated only because it did, unfortunately, go under the radar because of The Sixth Sense, and talk about bad timing where, like, this movie literally opens with a little boy talking to a ghost and people are like, we just saw this shit. Okay. It was the biggest movie in the world. We don't need to see your little micro budget artisan version of it.
Oh, artisan. When I saw the artisan logo, I was like, wow.
Yeah. Right.
Time capsule.
But I do just want to once more say that the MVP of this fucking movie, besides, it's the actress who plays Kevin Dunn's wife, who I need to look up. And I don't say that she's the MVP. I say it because when I saw this movie in 1999, when she popped up on screen, I was like, holy shit, that's Lucia Struss, I believe is her name.
Yes.
And I had seen her perform a number of times in Chicago as part of this thing called Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind, where they would do 30 little plays in 30 minutes. People would call out a number. They would jump up and grab a piece of paper that had a number on it, 1 to 30. They would perform that play, and then they would move on to the next one. If they finished all 30 in 30 minutes, they ordered one pizza for everyone. Everyone shared a pizza. And so I used to go pretty regularly. It was like this kind of thing to do at, you know, midnight in Chicago. And she was in the company there. So I had seen her perform a number of times. And then I was seeing Stir of Echoes. And I was like, holy shit, that's Lucia from Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind. But the real MVP of this movie is Catherine Irby, who I have mentioned a number of times because I'm just so crazy about her performance in this movie and how much she grounds everything and how much she humanizes everything. How much she makes me like Kevin Bacon even more, even as he's growing weirder and crazier. And the film kind of shifts its focus over to her. I just remember in 1999 developing a massive crush on Catherine Irby in this movie, and it has continued because I will, like, if I stumble across Law and Order Criminal Intent, I'm like, well, I'll leave this on because Catherine Irby's on this. And it all goes back to Stir of Echoes. I just think she's so terrific in this movie.
She is really, really great. Patrick, let me ask you a question. How many five-year-olds do you know have a baby monitor?
None.
Do you have a baby monitor?
I know one five-year-old and she has no baby monitor.
Okay. Because I have a three-year-old and he doesn't have a baby monitor. So
no.
Just one little thing. And then, I think we're coming down. We're definitely coming down on the side of Stir of Echoes. We're both fans of it. The scares are good. It's a quality movie. It's got, for me, some story issues, but at the same time, I might just be looking at the movie for where I would like it to go rather than where it goes. I do have one question for you about the end, and that's the U-Haul shot. The slow push-in shot on the U-Haul truck where Catherine Irby and Kevin Bacon sort of pass by each other a number of times. And there's that moment where their arms interconnect and there's sort of that long, you know, they sort of linger on each other for a little while. And, you know, using my visual skill, I'm saying, okay, well, this is meant to be, you know, to show that their marriage is they're reconnecting and that they're going to be okay. Yeah. Does that play for you? Okay, good. All right.
It does not for you. I never genuinely feel like their marriage is in trouble in this movie. And again, I think that's a credit to, and I know you had said that you wished that they had set it up more. To me, I think their relationship is so authentic, even in the way that they struggle, even in the way that they can argue or fight. To me, it just seems like a marriage that is going to be okay, with the exception of that one time, which again is part of that great scene where she says, never, you know, I've known you for 9 years. Never have you talked to me like that. And if you do it again, and she doesn't finish. And I believe her when she says it. At the same time, I don't feel like there's any part of her that wants to leave him, you know, and it's not an empty threat. So because I never feel like their marriage is in legitimate danger, and because I always feel like, hey, once Kevin Bacon figures this out, he's going to go back to just being a normal dude. That moment works for me.
Okay. Yeah. And I wasn't trying to suggest, like, I don't read that their marriage is in trouble either. I again, like you said, very authentic, in terms of the problems that they have, but I just, for whatever reason, I felt a little, I think it's just, it that kind of came up and I kept thinking it was paying something off that I wasn't really ever thinking about that having been needed to pay off. And I think that maybe because I don't necessarily see the connectivity between this issue being resolved and his frustration, their frustrations. I don't know. It's all just a mess in my head because I need structure and logic. And sometimes I just need to let it go a little bit, Patrick. I need to float with you up in the air.
Stop it.
We all flew.
I think it pays off everything it needs to pay off, you know, by That's saying fine. Essentially that that fine. Things are going back to normal, that their relationship is going to be okay, that they are obviously moving because this house is haunted, not necessarily by the spirit of Jennifer Morrison anymore, but by what their neighbors did, by the fights that they had in that house. I get saying, like, we need to get away from this place that now has bad memories. And then kind of says, things haven't changed for the sun. You know, like, things are back to normal for us. And then we zoom in on the sun, and it's like, yeah, but they're not. Which I don't necessarily read as sequel setup. I know you had said that earlier, and I know you weren't actually saying that they were trying super hard to set up a sequel. I know there is a Stir of Echoes 2, which I have not seen, and that kid does show up again, right? I read on Wikipedia.
I have not actually read that yet, so I'm going to do that now. Go ahead. Keep talking.
I believe the kid does show up in the sequel, so maybe it is sequel setup. I don't know. But I thought it was one of those where, again, it wasn't written to be a Stir of Echoes sequel, and then they kind of shoehorned it in. I don't know. So to me, that does kind of close off his arc as well, what little arc he has, you know?
Right. Yeah, no, it's totally fine. Again, I think what it is just this movie is on my mind, and I'm dealing with it, and I'm sort of going back and forth in terms of how I feel about it versus how I wish I felt about it. And I'll come down on it as being a good movie that I just need to revisit again, which maybe if I have time, maybe late in Scary Movie Month, if I'm trying to maybe get one more. You can't do more than one. Well, no, you can do more than one 7-word review per movie. Technically, we've allowed that, right?
Oh, sure. Anytime.
It counts, right?
I've watched movies more than once in October before, and each time I'll do a different 7-word review.
So maybe by the end of October, I will do one more Stir of Echoes review, along with Stir of Echoes 2, starring Rob Lowe, which you can bet your ass I'm going to watch, because I love Echoes, I love sequels, and I love Rob Lowe. Yeah. So
that movie's got all of them.
Yeah.
It's got all of those things.
But does he float in a theater?
Would you stop it? Anyway, that's going to wrap us up. As always, you can find all of our stuff at fthismovie.com. We're putting out a bunch of cool stuff for Scary Movie Month, so please check us out if you're new to the podcast. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Hit us up on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. Find the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, wherever you find your podcasts. Thank you, Rob, so much for talking about this movie with me. It was fun, and one of those where it's like I had no idea what we were going to talk about, and yet we had this great conversation about Stir of Echoes.
Happy Scary Movie Month, everybody. And Patrick, you know what? Next time, can we get some girls in this place? I'm really sick of all the balls in this house.
Listening to FS Movies.